We're going to pick up in verse 7. That's where we're at, but give you a little bit of an overview. Remember, Jacob now has packed up all of his family, and Joseph has moved all of them to Goshen, which is just right over here on the east side of Cincinnati. No, to Goshen, which is right outside of Egypt, all right? And so they're living there now, and so all the family has moved in, and they're all there. And so that's all said and done, but now comes the time for Pharaoh to meet Jacob, all right? Up to this point, he's never really met Jacob. He's only met Joseph, obviously, thinks the world of Joseph because he interpreted his dreams. He's now second in command of, Egypt and essentially the whole world. And so what we find here is now it's time for him to meet Joseph's family. And so Jacob now has an opportunity to come in and meet Pharaoh. And you see in verses 7 through 10, where that picks up. Verse 7 says, Joseph brought in Jacob, his father, and set him before Pharaoh, and Jacob blessed Pharaoh. Now, this is a big deal. Let me tell you why it's a big deal, because what happens here is, we talked a little bit about this before. Keep in mind that in Egypt, they worshipped lots of different gods. All right? They didn't like have a single god. They had several gods. And so they probably really, in all honesty, don't look to the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, all right, our God. They don't look to him as God, you know, supreme, the God, the only God. They don't look to him in that way. They look to him as if he's just another God among the many gods. But what they do know is this, is they recognize that even in that, he is obviously a God that's superior to his gods because of what Joseph could do through him. And Joseph always made a big issue out of the fact that whatever he was doing, the interpreting of the dreams and all those kinds of things, was directly a result of his God. And he never failed to mention that and to make sure that Pharaoh understood that. So to meet the father of a man that he admired and revered as much as he did, someone like Joseph who he really cared for and really felt compelled to put in this place, this position, and knew that he had a place in his heart for his God, he wanted to meet Jacob. And so this was a special honor even for Pharaoh to be able to meet Jacob. And so Jacob and Pharaoh both are in a mutual position to where it's an honor for them to come together and to meet one another. And it's because of Joseph being in the mix. But here is the deal. When they come together, Jacob blesses Pharaoh. Now, you know, I find that interesting because, first of all, he blesses him because, keep in mind, he is a leader. He is, you know, he's not a godly man or anything such as that, but he is a leader. And we have a responsibility all the way through Scripture to respect and honor our leadership and all of those kinds of things. And Egypt was in control. And so so what we find here is he respects that and honors that and blesses him in his leadership role and in all that he's doing and all that he does. And I find that interesting because he understands as much as Pharaoh understands that Pharaoh is indeed a real blessing to his family. I mean, because quite frankly, they could have starved to death over in Canaan, and it was important for all this stuff to take place. And so what happens is when he comes in, he respects that about Pharaoh and sees that Pharaoh honors and respects him, and he blesses him. It's an important thing. By the way, we're told, even in the New Testament, we're told to have a right relationship with our government leaders and with people in the government, whether it's even law enforcement, whether it's judges, regardless of who it might be, we have an obligation to respect them for their position and to keep peace between us and to honor the laws and all those kinds of things. They understood that and they realized that, and they were honoring that in that they were extending this blessing to Pharaoh. All right, so that's what's taking place here. In verse 9, let me kind of say a couple things here as well. In verse 9, it says, "And Jacob said unto Pharaoh, the days of the years of my pilgrimage are 130 years. Few and evil have the days of the years of my life been, and have not attained unto the days of the years of my life of my fathers in the days of their pilgrimage." There's a few things I wanted to kind of point out here. First of all, Jacob has a pretty pessimistic view about his life. I mean, think about it. He's looking at his life, and he's like, my days were evil. He was smart enough to know that all of his days were not God-honoring. He realized that there was a lot of his life that did not honor God in the fashion that it should. I mean, he has to be thinking about a lot of the things that had taken place. I mean, after all, you know, he could look back at the troubles in his life, whether it's him deceiving his father, the harm and the things that he did to Esau in that same regard, his conflicts with Esau all the way around, his conflicts with his father-in-law. And he could have saw that, you know, I've been thinking about that, his trouble with his sons. You remember the issues that took place at Shechem and some of those things. So, you know, he knew the issues had taken place with his sons, his daughter's rape, Joseph's supposed death, you know, that was all set up by his sons and he was lied to by his sons and all of that. Rachel's death because he loved Rachel and she winds up dying in childbearing. And all, you could just go on and on about some of the things that he recognized and some things that he knew about his life. And I find it interesting that he recognized that he wasn't nearly the man he should have been. He wasn't nearly everything he should have been in his life. And you know, when I was reading that, when I was studying that out, I began thinking about that, and I thought, how many of us can honestly say that, you know, in our entire life we've been everything we really ought to be? You know, and we look at times in our life, and there's a lot of times, there's a lot of things I'd really kind of like to forget. There's some things I would like for people to forget, you know. And there are things that you don't know about that I don't want you to know about. You know what I'm saying? So all of our lives probably have a mix of all of this. But in the midst of all of that, it is good, even, you know, not to get a pessimistic attitude about it all, because we understand and know we serve a forgiving God, a loving God, and to know that what God intends is for us to understand that we need him, that we're sinners and we're saved by grace. And it causes us to look to him and to realize that all that we have and all the blessings we have are a direct result of him. Jacob was at least able to see that. My days have been evil. I've done nothing good. I've done nothing that merits anything that God has done for me. You know, even the coming to Goshen and being able to see his son again, you know, who he thought was dead, and all of that, he recognizes that, look, I don't deserve any of this. In fact, my days have been evil and troublesome. It's by God's grace. It's by God's mercy that I have all of these things that I'm able to see and able to be a part of. So it's an important picture for him. Not only that, but he uses the word pilgrimage. It's kind of interesting to me because they really, I mean, that you remember when we talked about the word Hebrews? They're called Hebrews because basically that means that they are pilgrims, that, you know, they don't really dwell anywhere. They had left, you know, from Babylon and were always just kind of traveling and wandering and never really had any place they called home. They were always kind of settling in somewhere. I find it kind of interesting that even Jacob purchased land there around Shechem and then wound up moving to Hebron and didn't even live in the land that he purchased, you know. So it's kind of an interesting thing about the whole family. They were a pilgrimage. It was, they're always moving and always going and never settling down anywhere, you know. Isaac lived and was a Beersheba, and you know, and Abraham was here and there, and they never ever had a place where they just absolutely settled down and said, this is home. Even in the time they were in Hebron, keep in mind, they're living in a land that's not theirs. You know, they just settle there. So they're not really settling down anywhere and being able to say, this is ours, this is home. And so he calls it a pilgrimage, and that's what it is. He understands and knows they've not yet attained everything that God has promised them to Abraham, to Isaac, and to Jacob. And he recognizes that day hasn't come yet. We don't have all those things that God has given us yet. We're on a pilgrimage. I don't know if you realize or not, but you realize, you know that we're pilgrims. I know you might think that you're at home. You know, I own a home. Well, I don't. The bank owns it, but you know what I'm saying. You own a home, and, you know, you have your space, and you know where you live, and you have all these things. But in reality, all of us understand and know this is not our home. If we know Jesus Christ as our Lord and Savior, we're on a pilgrimage. We're here, and we're just pilgrims passing through, the song says. And so what we find is we have a home in heaven. All right, I've not even seen my home yet. You know, I can read about it. I can know some things about it, but I don't even grasp it. It doesn't make a lot of sense to me because it sounds too fantastic to even imagine. But this is not my home. And it's kind of a picture of who we are, even in Christ, because we're here and we have a job to do, and our job is to let people see and know Christ. By the way, if you get settled in and get satisfied with what you believe to be your home here, you'll never be pleasing unto the Lord. Because we can't ever be satisfied with this place. How could we ever be satisfied with this place knowing what we have waiting for us? You know, and so we need to understand that there's a job for us to do. Let me throw this at you. I do this sometimes preaching, so you've heard this before, but I'm going to say it again anyway. Too important not to. And it's this. When I get home, when I get to my new home, my fellowship with God will be absolutely perfect. I will understand and know things better than I could ever imagine here. I will know all that all that I need to know. I will have, you know, the new body, the likeness of Christ, all those things I will have. I will possess all of those things. And talking about even a prayer life, there's no need for prayer. I'll be right there in the presence of God to speak to Him, talk to Him. I have all of that. So when we reflect on that, I want you to think about this. Being here, there is only really one thing that we can do here that we cannot do there. And that's tell others about Jesus Christ. Yeah, see them come to know Jesus Christ as their Lord and Savior. That's the one thing we can do here that we cannot do there. So what does that say about our pilgrimage here? Our pilgrimage has a specific purpose. While we are, because we're here to study His Word, we're to pray and have fellowship with Him, all those things are things we need to do only because we're here. But if it was all about that, He'd just bring us home and we'd have all that. But because we need to tell others about Jesus Christ, share the gospel, we're here. So if we fail to share the gospel, if we fail to tell others about Jesus Christ, we have failed miserably. Because that's the one thing that leaves us here and doesn't bring us home. Does it make sense to you? All right. So I said all that to say that he recognizes there it's a pilgrimage. They have not yet arrived where God would have them to finally be. And don't misunderstand what I'm saying. That's not to say that Canaan is a type of heaven. We'll talk about that another time. It's a type of rest from being obedient unto the Lord. But regardless, they've not yet arrived. All right? They're pilgrims. But the next thing I do want you to see in that is when you look at this, he talks about, in verse 9, let me read over it again, make sure I don't miss it. He says, the days of the years of my pilgrimage are 130 years. Few and evil have the days of my years of my life been, and have not attained unto the days of the years of my life, my fathers, in the days of the pilgrimage. He's saying, my years are not what my fathers have been, all right? His father, Isaac, lived to be 180. Abraham, 175. He's 130. He's like, my years are not what their years are. And I realize they're not going to be. I get it. I know I'm not going to live that number of years. And he just makes a point of that just basically to say, you know what, God has used me, and what God desired to use me for has been fulfilled. And I get that. And I understand that I'm at that place. You know, I've got everything I wanted. I mean, I finished the race. You know, I got to see my son. And you'll find out when we get into chapter 48 some other things about that. But he says, I've been able to live and to see things that I wanted to see. My time is over, and I get that. God's through with me. Now it's time to use others. All right? So he gets that. And I think that is so important for us to genuinely understand and know. God has a specific purpose for us, and we need to fulfill that purpose. And so that when that day comes, when that time comes where God calls us home, we can honestly be like Paul and say, I've kept the faith, finished the race. You know what I'm saying? We want to be able to say and do all of that. When you get into verse 11, he talks about the fact that he says, Joseph placed his father and his brethren, gave them possession in the land of Egypt, in the best of the land, in the land of Ramesses, as Pharaoh had commanded. Kind of interesting. He doesn't say in the land of Goshen. All right? But we know that that is Goshen. It's an interesting thing. It wasn't even called Ramesses in that day. But remember what we talked about before, okay? We talked about the fact that Moses is writing this, 430 years plus from this moment, all right? So all of this has been written down 400 years later. So sometimes when he would write, he's writing in a more contemporary form. That is, he's writing to the people that he dwells with, he's talking to. It wasn't called Ramesses in that day. It was called Goshen. But in the day of Moses, Ramesses was a more common name for that land because of some things that had taken place with it and how it was indebted and inherited and things had moved around. So it became by a different name. In fact, the same land, when you get over in Psalm, I wrote down the Psalm. Let's see, which particular Psalm was it? Psalm 78. It's called Zone, or Zoan, Z-O-A-N. And so it goes by these three different names. But the point that I'm trying to make is sometimes when you tell a story or when you're telling an account, giving an account, you're going to give an account so that it's more familiar with the people you're giving the account to. All right. So while it was called Goshen in the day of Jacob and Joseph, it was called Ramesses, possibly not all the time, but it was also known in that way. So the people that Moses was writing to would be more familiar with it by that name. All right. So it's the same place. Same location, just making sure they understood where we're talking about.
It'd be like trying to explain the founding, the beginning of the city of Cincinnati. We all understand that, but it wasn't Cincinnati, it was Los Angeles.
Right, right. So if we said in the founding of it, we said, you know, they formed the city of Los Angeles, we could just as easily say they formed the city of Cincinnati and be correct, though it was not known as Cincinnati at the time. Same scenario, exactly. All right? Does that make sense to everybody? All right. Verse 12, what we find is in verse 12, Joseph then, he gets them all back together. He takes care of his father first, and then he takes care of his brethren and all of his father's household with bread, he says, according to their family. What he does is based upon the size of their family, he gives them their allotment of bread. Now, keep in mind that just because they had 7 years of plenty, and then they had 7 years of famine, you need to keep in mind that doesn't necessarily mean they had like surplus. All right, God gave them what they need to take care of everybody that came and needed something. But keep in mind, as you look at this, you see that Joseph was very cautious and very considerate about the things that he did and about what he gave. And so it was nonsense to give them more than what they needed. He made sure he gave them what they needed, because there was plenty of people that were going to be coming for years to come yet, because the famine is going to go on another 5 years. And so you want to make sure that, you know, he has done this according to God's plan so that he has food enough to take care of the folks as they come to them and takes care of everybody, and that, you know, and the famine doesn't just devastate them all. And so this is just good leadership, you know. When someone comes with a need, meet the need. If someone came to us, you know, and they had a genuine need, let's say they came and they said, listen, we have somebody in the church, you know, I got this medical bill and I got to pay it. Don't have no means of doing that. Can you help me? We decide to help them. The medical bill is $300. All right. And we decide, okay, let's give them the $300, help them with the medical bill. We don't give them $500 and say, hey, listen, just give the hospital an extra $200 in case something else happens. We give them what they need, because we understand that we may have a surplus. We may not have a surplus. That's neither here nor there. But we understand that those funds can be used elsewhere. And we want to be good stewards of those funds. Joseph is a good steward of the things that God has given him. So he doesn't just equally divide this and say, okay, here's what you got. He determines how much they get by the size of the families, which makes sense. All right? And so that's exactly what he does. And he provides that and gets it all distributed. And then verses 13 all the way to 24 is kind of interesting, because he kind of goes away from the family for a moment. You know, we've been talking about Jacob. We've been talking about the brethren. We've been talking about Joseph and his relationship and bringing them all in. All of a sudden here we get a few verses where it just kind of gives us a picture of the wisdom of Joseph, just to let us kind of see how he sets things up and how he does some things, because he sets up a system of, call it what you may, but it kind of boils down to taxation, all right? He says this. He says, okay, when you run out of money and you're unable to buy bread, basically we'll buy your goods from you, okay? We'll buy things you have to offer, you know, whether it be your livestock, whether it be your farm, whatever it is. You know, if it comes to that, for your family to stay alive, we'll purchase those things from you. If you get to the point where you literally have nothing, what we'll do is we'll help provide as much as we can, because after this famine's over, you're going to go back to growing crops. But if you don't have money, you know, you're not, or if you don't have farms, you're not going to be able to do that. You know, the famine, even though we have made sure there's plenty for everybody to be eating, you might be devastated, because you may lose everything you've got to make sure that your family has food. So some of the people wound up just moving into the city, you know, and rented houses or whatever it might be, and lived there. But some of them wanted to keep farming. Some of them wanted to stay where they were. Maybe they wanted to raise their families there, or whatever the case may be. And so they set up a system where they said, okay, here's what we'll do. We'll let you stay there and tend that farm. Once everything gets back on track, you're able to get seed, plant the seed, we'll let you stay there, tend that farm, but here's the way we're going to do it. All right? Everything that comes in, you give back to us 20%. All right? You give back to us 20% of everything that comes in, and that way you'll be able to sustain your homes and do all the things that you do, but you're going to have to pay the government 20% of everything you got. But we'll give you the startup. We'll give you the seeds. We'll give you the startup so you can do that. But understand, from here on out, give us 20%. And Moses says that system that Joseph set up with the people continued even unto his day. Right, so the system that he set up with the Egyptians to pay their government in order to stay there and to be able to do all those things remained intact even up until Moses' day. He was well aware of all of that. Okay, so those things were still happening and still taking place even then. So it was a system that Joseph set up that was good for the government but also good for the people. It doesn't sound like it would be to a lot of people because we live in a day and age where we think everything ought to be for us. Amen. You know, but the people were happy to do this, and the reason being was because otherwise they were going to lose everything. And there's good reason for them to be happy because, quite frankly, if it wasn't for the plan in their estimation that Joseph established, they would not have been able to feed their families, and ultimately not only would they have lost everything, but they would have all starved to death. So he provided a means for them to be able to stay alive. But secondly, he provided a means where they could at least stay where they wanted to stay and provide for their families there and take care of them and be able to put into it their efforts and their willingness instead of the government just taking care of them. They took care of themselves. And so it was a good plan. Yeah. I think I said that. Yeah. Yeah. So the system was a good system. Yes. And you know, basically it's the same system every government has to establish at some point in time, is that, you know, you invest in your government. Now, I realize, you know, we can all fight over how much and all that kind of stuff, but the whole concept is that you invest in your government so that you can have the kind of things that you have, all right? So that's kind of the way the system worked, and that's the way it was established, and Joseph is responsible for that. So he was responsible for establishing a system, and at the time, the most powerful nation in the world. And in addition to that, it was a system so good that it remained intact. And by the way, many other nations then implemented those things in their own nations. So that was a part of that, all right? So it just shows you what God did with Joseph and how he used him to handle all these things, even outside of his own family, but even within the ranks of Israel itself. How God blessed that nation, who was a nation that was alienated from him in regard to the fact that they worshiped false gods, yet just because of Joseph's presence, look how that nation was blessed. You know, I probably don't have time to deal with this, but I'm just going to say it. I'm going to try to make it real quick. Whether you realize it or not, some of the greatest contributions to our society, to our world, are from believers. Whether it be scientific things, you know, whether it's a Sir Isaac Newton, whether it be, you know, in our particular case, the way our government is established upon a church principle, we have contributed a great deal to our society. And I say that for this reason, that our nations are blessed because of you and I. You know, and I could take this to such great detail to show you so many different ones. I'm not going to take the time to do that. But my point being is there's so many things that have taken place over the course of time that it's obvious to see God's hand in it. And the blessings were not because the nation is such a righteous nation, but because God was blessing the individuals that were implementing these things. And so everybody reaped a blessing from that. God blessing Joseph benefited Egypt, even though Egypt was an ungodly nation. Make sense? All right. Verse 25, 26. Even though these people had lost now everything they had, and they're now under this 20% taxation, I'm going to call it, keep in mind, they were still very appreciative. If you look in those verses, you'll see that, because they understood that. Then verses 27, 28, Jacob had witnessed all of this now for 17 years, and it's getting to the place where now Jacob is at the point where he's about to die. All right, and we'll talk more about that in verse 48. He dies at the age basically of 147. In spite of all that was going on around him, God had seen fit for them to grow and for them to flourish. Interesting to me, because remember we talked about, you know, 60 to 70 people. New Testament said 75, whatever it was, in the beginning, about 70, 75 people. When they, after 430 years, left Egypt to go to the promised land, it's estimated at a couple of million. Isn't that wild? How God just calls them to flourish and calls them to grow and have blessed them as a nation so greatly during that time. And we talk about how horrific it was that they were there and they were in, you know, that they were slaves to Egypt and all those kinds of things. But the fact is, God used that time to bless them and to cause them to flourish and to cause them to grow and give them great things. And so, you know, keep in mind that it's not always the easiest of times that God blesses. Sometimes God is blessing through the most difficult times of your life, during even hardships. And then verse 29 through 31, let me read those for you. Verse 29 through 31, he says, "And the time drew nigh that Israel must die," that's Jacob, "and he called his son Joseph and said unto him, If now I have found grace in thy sight, put, I pray thee, thy hand under my thigh, and deal kindly and truly with me. Bury me not, I pray thee, in Egypt." I'm going to stop there for a second. Now, putting the hand under the thigh is just a way of just taking an oath or a vow. It was like you and I shaking hands on a deal, all right? And so he made his promise. He said, you know, I want you to do this. It's a form of a promise. And but the big issue is this. He says, if I found grace in your sight... He recognizes that although it's a very patriarch society, and he is the patriarch of the family, he still recognizes that the family has truly been blessed because of Joseph, that God has done great things through Joseph, and that he has brought him there, and how he has used him to do great things. Now, I'm going to say this as a dad, and dads, you guys probably understand this. Moms, you'll understand this as well. I don't care how great I become. I will take more pleasure in watching my children do great things than ever the things that I do. You know, there is something about seeing your children succeed and do well that just really touches your heart. You know, something incredible about that. In the case of Jacob and Joseph here, what Jacob is saying is, Joseph, I'm telling you, you've done great things, and I'm really pleased with who you've become and what you've done. And I know your position, and I know who you are, and I know I'm your father, but at the same time, you're the leader of the world, you know. And it had to be an awkward situation, you know what I'm saying? But regardless, this is the conversation, and this is what he's telling him. And he says, so if I found grace in your sight, I'm asking for one real favor. Don't bury me here in Egypt. Bury me in the promised land. God's made us a promise that we're going to have that land. I want to be buried there. All right? And he says, but I will lie with my fathers. Thou shalt carry me out of Egypt. Bury me in the burying place. And he said, I will do as thou hast said. So Joseph said, absolutely, that's what we'll do. You die, we'll take you and bury you where everybody else was buried. And he said, swear unto me. And he swore unto him. And Israel bowed himself upon the bed's head. All right, so we're at that point where he understands he's going to die. He is not to that point of absolute death, I'm going to die tonight yet, but he knows whatever it is, he knows within himself, my days are numbered. All right, and that's when all this takes place. And then when we get into chapter 48, I'm going to stop there. When we get into chapter 48, we see where he blesses Joseph's sons and so forth. All right, and that's where we'll pick up next week. All right, have you got any questions on chapter 47? Any questions on chapter 47? All right. I hope you're still enjoying this. We've only got a couple of chapters left, or, you know, two, three chapters left. But I hope you're still enjoying this. And I hope you see through all of this how important it is, really, to get a grip on some of the things that are taking place all the way back in Genesis that we might be able to see and see, find the groundwork and the foundation for what has taken place and where we are today. Because I think it really does establish a lot of things. And I've enjoyed, personally, studying this up to this point, and I really do hope you have as well. All right. We do have a quick business meeting tonight, so if